Bibles and turn to Revelation chapter 2. And this morning we are going to talk about the persecuted church, the church at Smyrna. Start at verse 8. And to the angel of the church in Smyrna write, "These things says the first and the last, who was dead and came to life. I know your works, tribulation and poverty, but you are rich. And I know the blasphemy of those who say they are Jews and are not, but are of the synagogue of Satan. Do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you in prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. He who overcomes shall not be hurt by the second death." All right, so last week we talked about the church at Ephesus, the big, successful church. It was a church very important to the region and became a focal point for so much church history. The church at Smyrna is about 35 miles north. Smyrna comes from an important product that they made there. Anybody know what it is?
Drywall.
Myrrh. Not drywall. What's that?
Myrrh.
Okay. Now most of us have heard of myrrh at Christmas time, right? It was one of the gifts the wise men brought. And if you've ever sung the song "We Three Kings," you'll know the passage says, "Myrrh is mine, its bitter perfume," right? And so myrrh was a very, very important spice that was primarily used in the embalming process. It had a very strong, pungent smell that was, because its connection with death was in some ways, you know, bitter in that sense. Did you find it? And it was an important part of the economy in the ancient days. The really important part was the production of myrrh. So Smyrna was known for that. Smyrna was a city that had done well for itself with that. They had really accepted Roman rule and were a city given to a lot of acceptance in Roman culture because of that. And they had developed an emperor worship, was very, very important in its time in Smyrna. And so, who's the most famous Smyrna? Does anybody know?
Most famous what?
Who is the most famous person from Smyrna?
Is that
Yes, it is, Anne. Very good. Polycarp. All right. So Polycarp is the most famous person that we have from Smyrna. And some of you probably are aware of this book, Fox's Book of Christian Martyrs, right? Mm-hmm. One of the most important and widely distributed books after two others. Anybody know the two more widely distributed books than this book?
Right.
The Bible.
Pilgrim's Progress.
Pilgrim's Progress.
It wasn't right? Betty Crocker's cookbook?
Not Betty Crocker's cookbook. No. And so, you know, a lot of early Christians in the post-Reformation days, after Gutenberg had created the movable type printing press, and they printed Bibles, they printed Pilgrim's Progress, which John Bunyan was late 1500s, early 1600s, and Fox's Book of Christian Martyrs. And so one of the very first chapters talks about Polycarp. Let me see if I can find it here. You have the apostles. After this respite, the Christians again came under persecution, this time from Marcus Aurelius in AD 161. One of those who suffered this time was Polycarp, the venerable bishop of Smyrna. 3 days before he was captured, Polycarp dreamed that a pillow under his head caught fire, and when he awoke, he told those around him he would burn alive for Christ's sake. Hearing his captors had arrived one evening, Polycarp left his bed to welcome them, ordered a meal prepared for them, and then asked for an hour alone to pray. The soldiers were so impressed with Polycarp's advanced age and composure that they began to wonder why they had been sent to take him. But as soon as he had finished his prayers, they put him on a donkey and brought him to the city. And as he entered the stadium with his guards, a voice from heaven was heard to say, "Be strong, Polycarp, and play the man." No one nearby saw anyone speaking, but many people heard the voice. Brought before the tribunal in the crowd, Polycarp refused to deny Christ, although the proconsul begged him to consider yourself and have pity on your great age. Reproach Christ, and I will release you. And Polycarp replied, 86 years I have served him, and he never once wronged me. How can I blaspheme my king who saved me?" Threatened with wild beasts and fire, Polycarp stood his ground. "What are you waiting for? Do whatever you please." The crowd demanded his death and gathered wood for the fire, preparing to tie him to the stake. "Leave me," he said. "He who will give me strength to sustain the fire will help me not to flinch from the pile." So they bound him, but they didn't nail him to the stake. As soon as Polycarp finished his prayer, the fire was lit, but it leapt up around him, leaving him unburned, until the people convinced a soldier to plunge a sword into him. When he did, so much blood gushed out that the fire was extinguished. The soldiers then placed his body into the fire and burned it to ashes, which some Christians later gathered up and buried. In the same persecution, the Christians of Lyon and Vienna, two cities in France, also suffered, including Sanctus, Martus, Attalus, and the woman Blandia, all who endured extreme torture and death with fortitude and grace. If you haven't read this book, you certainly should, so I highly recommend it. So Polycarp says, "I've served him 86 years, and that was in the year 161. And so if you figure he was, who knows, 10 years old when he became a believer, so 96 years old. We know that he was alive at the time that John wrote Revelation. And many of you are aware of others who've suffered persecution around the world. You've read them either in Foxes, you've heard more recent stories. Right now, it's estimated that there are about 200 million Christians persecuted around the world. There's 150,000 die annually. And there are 247 million in total poverty. These are our suffering brothers and sisters. And while we have so much, right? Yesterday, a friend of mine sent me a letter to the editor written, I'm not sure where in the country it came from, but it was written by a young man who was saying how recently he's become so aware of how the current generation likes to say, we've got to fix America, we've got to fix things because we've never known prosperity. Right? Does that make any sense? Mm-hmm. And this young man who wrote this letter is like, I look around me and I see people who can order food and have it delivered to them in minutes, playing on phones, driving cars, going wherever they want, having whatever conversations they want. And yet, The present young generation has the courage to say, led by folks like AOC and others, that they've never experienced prosperity. All right? And meanwhile, 247 million Christians alone, not counting others in this world, are in absolute, absolute poverty. We're not talking about American poverty. There's certainly people in America who have little and are suffering and don't have food or medical care. But we're talking about people in absolute, abject poverty. They have nothing. They're out in the garbage dumps of the world trying to find something to eat. 200 million of them who are Christians are persecuted, and 150,000 die annually. And so there are more Christians suffering persecution today, you know, and suffered in the 20th century than the total sum amount of all of those in the 19 centuries previous to that. And so Jesus writes this letter through John to the church in Smyrna that's suffering persecution. And what do we learn about what Jesus, what's his message to the church? Go ahead and look at the passage again. What are some of the highlights of what Jesus says to them? Before he says, be faithful, before he challenges them,
I know.
I know. I understand. And what one other really important thing? I am. Now, this isn't direct in this passage. You have to hearken back to the end of chapter 1 to answer this question. But what else does he tell this church?
First and the last. Alpha and Omega.
He tells them that, but that's not what I'm looking for. What do we know about where Jesus is?
Alive.
He's alive. More than that. What was he walking in the midst of?
Lampstands.
In the midst of the lampstands. And the lampstands are?
The churches.
So where is he?
He's with them.
I am with you. These are the three messages that Jesus starts off with to talk to this church. Okay? I know what you're suffering. I understand what you're going through. I'm with you. And because of those things, he can then challenge them to do what Dad said. What was the challenge to them?
Be faithful.
Be faithful. So he's saying, verse 10, he says, do not fear any of those things which you are about to suffer. Indeed, the devil is about to throw some of you in prison, that you may be tested, and you will have tribulation 10 days. Be faithful until death. Okay? Be faithful even to death. And what does he offer them?
The crown of life.
The crown of life. Now, depending on your translation and depending on who you listen to deal with this crown of life, commentary that I looked at says, you know, think of the crown of life. The crown is life. Okay, so it's not like you're wearing a crown here. The crown that you're receiving is to be alive. And this is a tremendous promise from Christ, right? So we have him saying, be faithful to death because you will live. Okay? There's no muddiness about this. There's no lack of clarity. There's no room for those out there who say there's no real resurrection. Okay? Because you come to a passage like this, and it's like, what does it mean to have eternal life? What does it mean that our faith brings us new life? Okay? Anytime you're questioning, what does that mean? Come to this passage. Because Jesus says, even though you die, you will be alive. Okay, I'm going to reward you with eternal life. Now, what else can we say about Jesus in telling them, I know, I understand, I'm with you, be faithful? What other lesson can we take from what Jesus is telling them and telling the persecuted church today? What, he's saying, be faithful, have hope, be assured of life to come. Okay, that's the top thing. Okay, I'm not disputing that. But what's the secondary desire of this church? And what is a prime desire of people in general who are faced with suffering and persecution, unfairness? What do people long for?
Do not fear.
Justice.
Justice. People long for justice. We long for justice. And the clear implication of this passage and of the entirety of the book of Revelation is justice is coming. Not slack in his promises, right? But he can be to us. Seems like a very long time. But what do we know about our God? Our God is holy and he is just. He's faithful, and justice is coming. What does it say later on in the book of Revelation as the martyrs are gathered around the throne? What do they ask? How long, O Lord, until what? Until you avenge our blood. Okay? Justice is coming.
But it doesn't mean you have to die, because we know that even though we're still here, that we still will live.
Yeah. I'm not. Go ahead and elaborate for us, Anne. I'm not sure what. No.
That's okay. I mean, the verse is be faithful unto death, and I will give you a crown of life. Doesn't mean that you have to die.
No, not everyone in the persecution would die. No, I understand that. And it says, right, that he who overcomes. What about he who overcomes? Okay. You might overcome by dying in the persecution, or you might have to overcome by doing what? Persevering to the end of natural life as well. Okay? And the wonderful thing here, I love this about verse 11, is it says that he who overcomes, which is anyone who's a true believer, won't be hurt by the second death. Okay? And so we have this clarity from Christ that there's the first death, okay, and we're going to experience that. You're going to have the first death one way or the other, under persecution or through natural death, but you won't be hurt by the second death. And the book of Revelation later on talks about it, clarifies to us, what is that second death? It's the death that comes with judgment and eternal punishment. And so we see Jesus here with a message. Verse 10, kind of the quick message, right? Do not fear. I wanted to show you a video from Voice of the Martyrs this morning, but I mean, technical problems. there's a lot of amazing videos of Christians around the world We watched one here probably, I don't know, 6-7 years ago during Prayer for the Persecuted Church, which is October, I think, right? September, October is when they have the National Day of Prayer for the Persecuted Church. And I remember in some of the countries where the persecution is severe, watching Christians who are in such poverty, they take whatever job they can get. And the only jobs that they would give them in these countries are cleaning outhouses. And you watch men climb down into these pits and bail out outhouses all day long just so they can feed their families, just so they can go to church and praise God. I watched a Voice of the Martyrs video that he interviewed a lady who had been imprisoned in China for 6 months because she held a house church. And when he interviewed her about how her time in prison was, expecting some story about lack of food and misery, instead she said, it was a wonderful time. It was a wonderful time. Jesus was there with me the entire time, ministering to me. And she said, the other six ladies in the prison cell with me, they didn't know Jesus when I got there. But when I left, they all knew Jesus. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so the amount of what our brothers and sisters are going through, we shouldn't forget about. Peter tells us in his epistle to pray for those who are persecuted as if it was we who were suffering with them. Okay? And to not forget those who are suffering and are in chains for the gospel. What would Polycarp tell us today? If he was here right now, and then if we could have him come and visit us, what would he tell us? What would he tell every suffering Christian? It was worth it, right? You think of the song, it will be worth it all. And another great song, Martin Luther said, let goods and kindreds go, this mortal life also, the body they may kill, God's truth abideth still. Okay? It will be worth it all. His kingdom is forever, right? And so if Polycarp could be here, he'd be like, you should see what I've had for the last 2,000 years, right? For that momentary suffering, what I've been privileged to have, right? Eye has not seen, nor ear heard, nor mind conceived of what God has in store for those who love him. And so this present suffering, there's a verse that Paul has, and I meant to look it up for you, but I didn't find it, right? But he says, I judge this present suffering. Can anybody quote it? How it goes? Anna, you're letting me down now.
Not worth it. No, I've got several.
What's that?
Not worth the glory.
Yeah, I count this present suffering not comparable, not worth even measuring up to the glory ahead for me in Christ Jesus. Okay? And so we see that the church has these options. Crown now versus crown later. What are we supposed to be, as believers, looking for? The crown we can get now? No. The crown later, the crown of life to come. And another saying that we could look to. First, crown later. James chapter 1. James 1. Verse 12. Blessed is the man who endures temptation, for when he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. The Lord has promised the crown of life to those who love him. Now, in America, today, are we suffering? What's the American church's biggest fear? Freedom. Yes.
The loss of, persecution coming to us.
Yeah, you worry about persecution. Rejection. Now, when you think about the things that the American church fears, and I'm not saying it's wrong to be anxious to some degree that we could lose these things and what that would mean, especially, you know, when it comes to the loss of security, loss of freedom, you know, the opportunity to meet together freely, to raise our children as we see best, to worship God freely. I'm not saying it's unnatural to be anxious about any of these things, so I'm not offering that as a criticism. But what I want you to think about is not so much these things at the moment, but how does the American church traditionally envision the loss of these things? How do we see it coming?
The government taking it away.
Government. What else?
Culture.
Culture. Okay, that's the answer I want to get to.
Okay.
But there's one more I want to say before government. Or with government. Huh? No. No, good thought, though. That one we'll kind of cover that with culture. But no, we think about force, okay? So whether it's government force or an army, you know, somehow or other they're going to, you know, some of you might remember Moody put together this radio drama back in the 80s. It wasn't called Left Behind, but it was about that, right? It was about the rapture, and this lady was left behind, her husband was gone, and the army started moving in, and she was getting arrested. We think of a police state. We think about Nazi Germany and SS troops moving in and arresting people. We think about China and the lady that I mentioned and others who, you know, they have a church meeting, the army comes, arrests them. We think of the KGB in Russia secreting people away and taking them to the gulag, and their family doesn't know if they're ever coming back. They might not even know where they've gone, okay? And that's what we often, I think, tend to think about when we think about the loss of freedom, the loss of comfort, where it's going to come from, how it's going to come. But I would venture to suggest to you that the one that were less prepared for is the one that comes with a changing culture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it's a society rejecting truth. And especially a society that refuses to listen to truth. Okay, they don't want to hear it. They don't want to hear you say it, and they don't want to tolerate it. Okay, we look to a society that wants to tolerate everything but truth. Okay? Everything but truth is what we live in right now in America, a post-truth society. And what are the risks to Christians in this post-truth society, in a society that doesn't want to hear it? What's the number one risk to Christians in a society that won't tolerate hearing things they don't want to hear?
Compromise.
Okay, these are all good answers, right? So then one of the risks spiritually, one of the risks, you know, truly, is what Jody mentions, is that the church goes silent, okay? And doesn't speak for truth, okay? And that's an excellent point. But I want you to think more functionally. What do we as Christians risk in a society where we might stand for truth and they don't want to listen? What do you risk? What's the tangible, immediate risk?
Do we compromise? Compromise?
No, you're still thinking you're still thinking big picture stuff. I want you to think very small, tangible risk. What's your risk?
I have rejection.
Rejection where? What do we need? What does every human need?
Food. Salvation.
Job.
There's our pastor over here, you know, just dropping truth bombs and ruining my lesson, you know. No, you need jobs. You got to work. You got to earn your keep. You got to earn your bread, okay? You got to have a job. You got to make money, okay? And what did I tell you? Those Christians in Southeast Asia, the only job they'll give them, cleaning the toilets. Okay? And not the nice toilets. Okay? And so we see, even just in the last few years, right, as the DEI, the diversity, equity, and inclusion thing came along, we're going to actually hire people based on skin color rather than on their qualifications for the job or on their sexual preferences. Because, boy, we need to have a job force that has this wealth of popular fad experience rather than on who's actually good for this employment. Okay? And that was really cracking open a new trend for America in modern times, right? The idea that you could discriminate in hiring, right? Some of you who grew up in the 60s know they used to discriminate in hiring, and we cracked down on that, said stop it. And I'm not saying everything went hunky-dory and that there were still people working the fringes, but it wasn't legal to discriminate for hiring. And then suddenly, now we're making it not just legal, but we're saying you must discriminate in your hiring. And what's the Christian left to do? How do you decide how much compromise am I going to do so I can feed my family? Okay, Tom, you show up to work, and they say, "Hey, in your contract for this year, you have to pledge to not say anything about the guy who's transitioning to being a woman." Okay, and are you going to stop feeding your family over that? And how big does that promise have to be for you to decide this violates my fidelity with Christ? This goes a bridge too far, right? Could Polycarp have said, "Hey, I'm 96 years old. Jesus knows me. I know him. He knows that if I just say, hey, I really don't want to get burned today, it'll be all right. Okay. Where do we draw these lines? And I have talked to this class in years past, so some of you weren't here then. But as Christians, if we don't start preparing ourselves now to know where the lines are, when the lines do come, it's very easy to, well, I can go a little bit further. I can go a little bit further. Where is that line that I can't cross? Well, it's just a little bit further than the line that's in front of me right now. Right? And it's really challenging if you haven't already made a firm commitment ahead of time to where that's going to be. I think that what we've seen in America so far is that the courts and the systems have managed to hold strong and protect people's ability. It's not always perfect, and there's sometimes a wayward path to get there. But in general, we still have the Constitution and such saying that the government can't discriminate in hiring. A few years ago, during Biden's time, they tried to create a program that was giving free money to farmers who were not white. Some of you might remember that. And a bunch of farmers sued and said, how can you possibly use skin color to decide who can apply for this program, which was basically a free loan that you never had to pay back. And the courts took years, but they finally came up and said, yeah, that's not right. I think that the bigger danger to us is in the society. It's not so far from government. It's in AT&T. It's in systems or boss. It's at Verso. It's at the universities. It's at Disney. It's at private companies who start this trend, right? And say, hey, just sign this little thing in the contract that you agree to use inclusive language, that you're going to ask everybody their pronouns before you talk to them, that you're going to put your pronouns on your emails. And where does that go to? Okay, because we are into a society that does not tolerate people speaking truth. And if you think it's far away, it's just 100 miles north of us in Canada, right? I don't know how many of you listen to Christian radio, but if you listen to any of the programs like Dr. Dobson's program, Focus on the Family, if you listen to Back to the Bible and a number of other ones, they literally have different broadcasts for Canada when they get into certain program topics that they're not allowed to put on the radio in Canada. Or the radio station will be taken off of the air. So Jody says, for the church believers can go silent and not speak. Keep it all hidden inside. But then it just gets nibbled away at, right? And so persecution is not that far from us at any time. It's not here yet. But suffering and persecution are around the world, and they're not far from us. Any thoughts that you have? Joey?
I have a daughter in law.
Yeah.
And I said, I worry that there's a time coming when you could lose your job because you don't want to, you're not going to do what they ask you to do. Are you fearful of that? And she really didn't answer that, but she said to me, I feel passionate about teaching kids in the public school. She said, I feel I might be the only Christian person they ever encounter. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I've heard many Christian teachers say that.
So that would be hard to draw.
Other thoughts? Yeah, Deb.
To me, in the church, especially the Bible-believing fundamental churches, is separation. I mean, easily for years and years, is a Christian really stood for a strong belief system, and now we're doing so much like the world. The drinking, the being in the bars, going to weddings, having weddings that don't honor God. I mean, it's just everywhere. And I shopped at Kohl's this week, and there was a transvestite, I don't know what you call them, but anyway. And it's just more and more every day,
right.
More and more. and Christians, supposedly Christians, and not separating themselves from the world. They're taking in more and more. And I'm talking a lot of people that went to Northland Baptist Bible College and other Bible colleges and stuff, and people have gone away from Christ and his holy word.
And then I think we also have to be wise in the world we operate in, right? Mm-hmm. And I talked to someone this week, you know, about what it should our interactions be out in the secular world as Christians, mm-hmm. Okay? Now, you'll have Christians who want to protest funerals. You'll have Christians who come up to the cashier and they won't, well, I'm not going to do business here because of who you have running the cash register. And I would say, you know, as Christians in this world, we're not called to go out and say, well, I'm not going to go to this gas station. I'm not going to go to this grocery store because of, I still have to buy food,
right?
And if we read our New Testaments, we see that the Christians at that time still lived in that secular society around them, and still had to go to the meat markets. Mm-hmm. They still had to go out and buy goods. And it wasn't a Christian society at all. And so we have to figure, are our lines, are we promoting the cause of Christ by expecting non-believers to act in a Christian way, mm-hmm. right? And so there's that delicate balance, right? And so, you know, I have a good friend of Sarah's and mine whose sister has decided to marry a woman. And should she go to their wedding? Her sister fully knows where she's at. She knows that she doesn't support what she's doing. And if she goes, can she be a minister for truth while she's there? Can she be ministering to other people who are confused who are there? Can she help her parents who aren't believers by being there to show love to her sister, but also remind them, I don't agree with what you're doing? And so these are really complex questions that we're not going to just answer this morning, but I want us to at least lay some groundwork that I'm not telling you to go out there and start carrying signs and looking to only do business with businesses that are perfectly walking the doctrine of First Baptist Church of Norway, okay? Because that's not what I'm saying, okay? But are we living lives that are connected with truth? Are we focusing on truth? Are we unafraid to speak up when it's appropriate to speak up, okay? These are hard questions, and we're running out of time to get too much further today. So I hate to leave you kind of on a cliffhanger about it. We can talk about it more next week. Anne, were you going to say something real quick?
We already know, we don't really know what suffering is. But when you think of Paul, Saul, who was struck with blindness, and then Ananias was told to go to him. And so he wasn't even a believer yet. But then Ananias was told to go to him, and he says, Paul, he's my chosen vessel.
Yeah.
I will show you great things he will have to suffer for. I don't know if that was the verse you were looking for before or not.
So let's plan to talk a little bit more about it next week before we move into our third church, which is the compromising church. And so there'll be some actual interesting synergies to continue this conversation next week. So sorry to leave you on that cliffhanger. Read ahead, study some more. Let's pray.